Succession number 27344, Wheel 9.
Tell us, Wheel 9.
Right, we just finished at East Haven, and I was sent on leave for, I think, a couple of weeks. And then I was appointed to join 827 Squadron in HMS Furious, which was at that time in Scapa Flow. So there I was, a midshipman RNVR, wearing purple patches. And I set off by train to Thurso. When I got there, it was very late, and I was wandering around for a couple of hours during the night, and then went to join the ferry going over to Kirkwall. And I suppose I joined about 4 o'clock in the morning, and the ferry set off into the Pentland Firth, and the Pentland Firth is often very rough, and it was on this occasion. And this ferry was corkscrewing along, and I was beginning to feel a bit miserable because I was excited at what I was going to do, and the movement of the ferry really was quite violent, and I was just beginning to feel a bit seasick when suddenly the captain switched on the public address system. And it was the 6 o'clock news. And they started off, "Our forces have landed in Normandy." It was the 6th of June. And of course, I absolutely forgot everything about my seasickness. I was just listening to the news with the greatest interest. And that went on for quite a long time, for most of the way across the Pentland Firth. So I got across without being seasick, which is quite good.
Actually, anyway. How you felt about that time? Because obviously Britain had been at war for 5 years at that point. And how were people feeling to hear about the invasion of Europe?
Oh, well, most of us, I suppose, from the news knew that there was something afoot. And I knew lots of people who were involved. And I was just excited for them. Not that I wished to be there particularly, but I was just excited about it all.
Did people feel, though, that obviously the invasion of Europe was going to, you know, speed up the
beginning
end
of the
war?
End. Yeah, I think we did feel that, that it was the beginning of the end, because as the news came out, it was obvious there was a very, very major landing on the French coast. And we also knew that the landings that we had previously in Sicily and in Italy had all been successful. The Italy one wasn't as successful as it should have been, or could have been, mainly because of the American general involved, but the rest had all been okay. So we thought, well, with a bit of luck, this one will be okay as well. And as the news started to come out, we were hopeful that it really was the beginning of the end. Anyway, we got into Kirkwall, and I got ashore with my gear, and find out where the Liberty boats left from so that I could go off to join HMS Furious. So she was out in the flow, and a lot of other ships as well. Anyway, I finally got on board HMS Furious, and I was shown where to put my gear. And I went into the wardroom mess because there was no gunroom. And as a midshipman, you don't normally live in the wardroom mess. So I went into the wardroom with my purple patches on, and I was taken and introduced to the squadron CO, who was an Irishman, very nice man. And he turned round to say hello, and he looked at me, and he said, "You can get those bloody things off right now." And this was June, and I wasn't supposed to be promoted to sub-lieutenant until September. However, I was ready for it. So anyway, I went away and got organised in sub-lieutenant's uniform instead of midshipman's. But it was a surprising greeting as far as I was concerned. Anyway, I was a very naive, green person. Not only was I a new pilot, but I really was naive and shy. Anyway, I met some of the people from the squadron and they were talking to me. And of course, I was a bit apprehensive because I was replacing some, I think it was one of four crews that had been killed up the Norwegian coast. So I really was apprehensive as to what was going to happen.
Were you the only person arriving as replacement crew? Or
yes, I was the only one at that particular time, yeah. So anyway, I was then crewed up with an observer and an air gunner. And I felt very sorry for them. Because they must have looked at me and thought, bloody hell, how long are we going to live with him? Anyway, we went ashore to to Hatston in the Orkneys. Now, Hatston was one of three naval air stations in the Orkneys. Hatston, Skibray and Twat. Can't remember the names of them from the naval point of view. But they were all very primitive airfields, to put it mildly. I mean, Hatston, for example, what they'd done was they found a straight stretch of road on the main road going west from Kirkwall and put a fence at either end and then built an airfield around it. And the main runway was the main road. And in a barracuda, with a spread of the undercarriage, it took up most of the main road when it was landing on. And because of the big nose, 12 feet of nose ahead of you, you just couldn't see the main road. As far as you're concerned, you're landing on grass. So it was very difficult. But anyway, we got ashore and I was allocated an aircraft. And we flew around just local flying, getting used to it. Anyway, ashore at Hatston, we were flying around doing local flying and then practice anti-submarine bombing, which is a matter of flying with four 250-pound depth charges and simulating seeing a submarine conning tower or snorkel or whatever and going in to attack it. Now, you would fly on an anti-submarine patrol at a height which would allow you to see the periscope or snorkel or whatever it was that was sticking out of the water, which means in calm weather you could fly reasonably high and get a wide view. In rough weather you had to fly really quite low, because trying to pick out a periscope amongst white top waves is very tricky, and you would be flying maybe at 1,000 feet or 1,500 feet in the hope that you were going to see something. So if you did see something, you had to be able to turn in quickly and deliver your anti-submarine weapon from really quite a low height, low speed. And again, we had no bomb sight, so it was a matter of judgment as to when you released the depth charges so that you were going to straddle this particular submarine. So that's what we were off doing, practicing doing that. And again, we did practice with 25-pound practice bombs, and you could look back over your shoulder and see whether the smoke showed that you had straddled the target or not. But you had to do it. We had to do it off at sea, and what we used to do quite often was to drop a coloured smoke float, and then whiz round in a circle and drop the practice bombs on it. And you could tell the difference between the colour of the practice bombs and the smoke float to know just how accurate you had been. So we were off doing this, and I flew with one or two different observers and air gunners just to get used to flying with different people.
Could I just ask about, obviously with the observer and the air gunner, what kind of seating arrangement you actually have in the boat, and which way they're facing, and which way you're, obviously you're facing forward, but which way they're facing and how they sit?
Yes. Well, the observer is immediately behind the pilot, but there's a fair amount of radio stuff in between, radio boxes and that sort of thing. And although there was a hole in the bulkhead behind the pilot here, the observer was supposed to be able to reach through and give you a note if you required it. But he had to have very long arms, and we had to have double-jointed arms in order to get this to work. So it was never used. He used to either sit low down in the aircraft, strapped in down there, and he had two windows either side of him. Now, these were like bay windows, and he could put his head into the bay window and see straight forward and straight back. And it was most important that he could, because one of his main jobs was to do wind finding. I'll tell you about that in a minute. His other alternative was to stand on his seat wearing a lanyard to his harness, so that if the aircraft did something silly, at least he wouldn't be thrown out. And he could stand high enough to look out of the greenhouse on top, so that if it was more convenient, say, for photography, he could slide his hood back and stand there with his camera and take a clear view picture rather than going through his bay window, which might not be very clean. So he had the two positions that he could use. And he could also turn round and see and signal to the air gunner. Now, the air gunner had a seat at the back of the greenhouse, and he could face either forward or aft. He could face aft with his guns, or he could face forward with his wireless telegraphy. And we had a wireless telegraphy set which required an aerial to be streamed. So when we took off and we were clear of the water, he would ask permission to stream his aerial, and then he would start to signal to the ship just to establish contact. And then he wouldn't signal again unless there was something urgent to signal about. But then he had to remind the pilot that the aerial was streamed behind him if the pilot started doing low flying. Otherwise, he'd lose his aerial. Anyway, it was his responsibility to get the aerial in and out at the right time and to make WT contact. We didn't have RT contact over very long range at all. We could probably speak to the ship in the circuit, but not very much further. So anyway, we're flying around with our observers and getting used to that. And we went off, and I went off on my first anti-submarine strike. This was up the Norwegian coast, and there was a report of submarines at this particular position, but I can't remember exactly where it was now. But there were four aircraft went off, and we all went off in slightly different directions to cover the maximum area we could. So there I was on my first operation, wondering if I was going to see a submarine and would I be able to deal with it. It was really quite a nice day. There wasn't a lot of wind, so there wasn't a lot of sea.
Right.
So we flew around to the position where this was supposed to be and then did a search in that area. Didn't find anything, and set off back for the carrier at the end of our patrol time. The observer gave me the course to steer, and at the end of the time he reckoned that we should be coming up to the ships. He said, "Can you see them?" And I said, "No, there's nothing in sight." And at the actual time, there was not a ship in sight, which worried me somewhat. So I said, "Well, what do we do now?" They said, "Well, we do a square search and see if we can find the fleet." So we start. Square search is a situation where you fly into wind for a minute, crosswind for a minute, downwind for 2 minutes, crosswind for 2 minutes, into wind for 4 minutes, and so it goes on. And you gradually extend the area of the search. And on the third leg into wind, I suddenly saw a smudge of smoke on the horizon. Now that's unusual, and was very lucky, because naval ships at sea in operational conditions do their level best to avoid making smoke. But anyway, there was enough smoke from one of the ships for me to just pick it out on our eyes, and we set off in that direction. And it happens that just after we took off and set off towards the Norwegian coast, the fleet had a submarine report close at hand. So the fleet retired westwards at high speed, and they don't tell us on the wireless what they're doing, because it then gives away their position. So they set off in radio silence, and we carried on our flight in radio silence. And I was somewhat relieved to get back ultimately. And instead of being about 2 hours in the air, we were nearly 3 hours in the air. But luckily we had the fuel to do it. So that was my first operational trip.
In a case like that, normally though, although you were doing your square search, would they have at some point re-established contact with you?
No.
So conceivably, there could be a situation where you may never make the ship again.
That's right. But it does happen. Anyway, that was my first trip, and we went off again same day to Hatstone, where we did some more dive bombing practice, and then we started to do some B bombing, B for Bravo. Now, the B bomb was a 250-pound bomb in a flotation chamber, which made it, I suppose, about 8 or 9 feet long and about 2 feet diameter. And we were able to carry two of these, one under each wing. Now, the purpose of this bomb was for it to be dropped ahead of a ship and to go down into the water, and then the flotation chamber would bring it up again under the ship. What a cunning idea. I don't know who thought it up. But anyway, we did quite a lot of the practice with this, with ships from the home fleet. And as far as I know, practice was a complete failure. And although we did it for, the best part of a month, I don't remember anything coming of it at all. So B-bombing, as far as I was concerned, was a bit of a failure.
Would you still apply the techniques you'd used to dive bombing with the B-bomb?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Then we went on, and once again, we were practicing in large numbers, as many aircraft as we could get into the air, and in a small space over a target at one time, so that once again we were trying to divide the anti-aircraft fire that was being brought to bear. And we went to a place that I noticed in my logbook, it's called Port ZH, and this was in fact an island way in the north of Scotland, and the island was the same shape and size as one of the German battleships, and this is what we used as our target for this particular exercise. Now then, the reason for this was that we were practicing for another attack on the German battleship Tirpitz, and we did this, and we actually dropped live bombs on this island just to get the proper practice in. So the whole squadron, which if I remember rightly was 18 aircraft, was airborne, and we were getting in as fast as we could, all 18 aircraft, dropping our bombs and away. And it looked and sounded very impressive, I must say. Anyway, we went on the 22nd of August 1944 to attack the Tirpitz. Now, on this occasion, I was flying with a 1,600-pound bomb, just the one armour-piercing bomb. And the brief for me was to drop the bomb at the maximum speed I could raise at 4,000 feet, so that the bomb would reach its terminal velocity before it struck the ship, so that it would get the maximum amount of penetration. Now, once again, in order to get out of the close-range anti-aircraft fire, we aimed to be over the target at 12,000 feet. Now, Barracudas with bombs were very slow in climbing. And to get to 12,000 feet over the target, we had to start climbing about 50 bloody miles away. So needless to say, the Germans had lots of notice of our arrival, because we actually started climbing over the sea before we reached the Norwegian coast. And the Tirpitz was in a fjord called Karfjord, off the Olten Fjord, and must have been, I suppose, 30 miles, maybe more, inland. So they had plenty of warning of our arrival. And when we got there, they had lit smoke generators on the downwind side of the fjords. And the whole of the fjord was filled with smoke, and we couldn't pick out the target at all. So we flew over that, and the leader decided that it was a waste of time dropping the bombs. We'd go away and try another day. So we set off, and we came back again on the 24th. And once again, I was carrying a 1,600-pound bomb. And once again, unfortunately, the fjord was filled with smoke. But the Tirpitz was firing its heavy anti-aircraft guns. Now, the heavy anti-aircraft guns are not very accurate when they're aiming at aircraft. So what they aimed to do was to fill a box above the ship with as much high explosive as they could, and they just kept firing all their big guns into this box and hoped that we would fly into it. Well, of course, to get to the dive bombing position, we had to. So it was just a little bit frightening flying in amongst these. But once you got into the dive, you just didn't notice them at all. And not having an accurate aiming point, we just aimed at the flashes of the big guns. So we all went in and dropped our weapons. We've no idea how many hit, but there was some damage done to the ship, enough to stop it from going to sea. So what between the damage done then and the damage done in May, when they had actually got to the ship before the smoke started, and the damage done by the midget submarines, the Tirpitz was not in a fit state to fight. So in fact, it didn't leave Karfjord until sometime much later, when it was towed down to Tromsø. And when they towed it to Tromsø, I think it was intended to repair it, but they made a mistake, because in fact they brought it within the range of the RAF heavy bombers. And they were able to go off with the bomb they called Tallboy, which was a 12,000-pound bomb. And they got hits with the 12,000-pound bombs, and that was the end of the Tirpitz. But it was exciting as far as I was concerned, because once again, as a 19-year-old, I thought this was all bloody exciting. And it was too.
Prior to the operations, in your briefing, were aerial reconnaissance photographs available for you of the fjord?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had very good pictures of where the ship was lying in the fjord. And, of course, the outline of the fjord, the mountains around it, we were able to pick out the layout of the place really quite clearly. So we knew that the big guns that were flashing were, in fact, in the target. So that was all we could aim at.
Was there also anti-aircraft defence around the fjord as
oh,
well?
Oh, yes. There were light aircraft, anti-aircraft, mainly on what they expected to be our escape routes, I suspect. So once I had dropped my bomb, I just got down and as low on the water as I could and went out through the mouth of the fjord and then down Olten Fjord back to the sea. And that was a lovely ride. It was a beautiful day. And the Norwegians were out there waving to us as we went past. And we were just flying along very low level, enjoying it thoroughly. But once you got away from the area of the battleship, there was no anti-aircraft fire at all. So it was just low-flying and enjoying it.
During the action, were you able to see other aircraft around you?
Oh, yes. There was we had fighter aircraft who were intended to keep the light anti-aircraft fire to a minimum, and they were flying round the sort of outskirts, firing at anything that moved, virtually. And again, you see there were... I'm not certain, but there must have been 36 or 40 barracudas all attacking at much the same time. I'm sure my cough's being such a nuisance. Yes, there were quite a lot of aircraft, and we attacked as fast as we could. So, at the time, there were a lot of aircraft around us.
And after an attack like that, would you all make your own way separately back to the aircraft carrier?
Yes.
There was no idea of reforming?
Not really. Once you got back to the ship, you would reform in the fleet area so that you could have a controlled landing-on situation. But the Furious was a very unusual carrier. It had originally been a cruiser, and it had been adapted for flying, first of all, by putting a flight deck on the forecastle, up forward of the bridge, and then it was adapted by putting a landing-on area aft of the bridge. But the bridge was still there in the middle. And then as the aircraft got a wee bit bigger and a wee bit faster, they decided that they would modify the ship entirely, and they took it in and removed the bridge and all the stuff in the middle and had a complete deck from forward to aft. But the thing is that in order to operate the ship, they had to have a conning position for the captain and the ship's officers, and that was in a small blister on one side, right up forward, the forward end of the flight deck. And the air control position was in another blister on the port side, right up forward. And there was a very small erection on the starboard side, like the modern island, but very, very much smaller, where wireless stuff was fixed. And the wireless aerials were fixed to hydraulic masts, which could be raised for normal operation and lowered for flying operations. And the ship's exhaust system, to get the smoke out of the ship, there were two gratings right at the after end. And the smoke would come through and up through these gratings and away. And the trouble is that to get the maximum number of aircraft off at any one time, some of the aircraft were parked right aft on top of these bloody gratings. And of course, with the smoke coming out, even if it wasn't heavy smoke, there were hot gases coming out, and it was absolutely choking. So any aircraft that was parked on there, as soon as they got in, they all had to put on oxygen masks and wear oxygen. But anyway, it worked. But the other thing which was, there were other things. They had thought that in order to help aircraft to gain speed for takeoff, that they would have a slope downwards in the flight deck, close to the after end, so that just forward of the position where the smoke was coming out, they had a gradient downwards into the middle of the ship. And then in order to help the fighters get off, at the forward end, they had another gradient upwards, like rather similar to the ski jump on the Hermes. And forward of that gradient, the deck levelled off between the positions of the captain's position and Commander Eyre's position. So the flight deck was really quite crowded. And the four arrestor wires were in the hollow in the middle of the ship. Anyway, flying from the Furious was really quite an exercise. And it had no barriers. Remember, I was talking about emergency barriers. It had no barriers. So each time an aircraft landed on, it had to be struck down on the forward lift. And the forward lift itself was shaped like an aircraft, big cross, because they had been flying Hurricanes from the ship, and the Hurricanes didn't fold. So in order to strike them down into the hangar below, they had to have the hangar, they lift wide enough for the wingtips, but not taking up all the space. So there was this aircraft-shaped lift up forward, and you would taxi forward onto that, and the Barracuda wings were folded manually, so the ratings would be there, and fold your wings, and as the wings were folded, you would stop the engine, and the lift would start to go down. And down in the hangar, the ratings would push you off the lift, and you were then safely